This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Sakina Francis was living a comfortable, successful life, a college graduate with a career and a young family, until schizophrenia tore that life and that family apart.
Yeah, I just knew that at times my mom would act a little bit different, but then I was so young, I just kind of thought that was my mom.
On today's Health Show, we'll talk to Sakina and her daughter about life with her illness, the letters to her daughter, and the book they've written together.
We'll also hear from a veteran national reporter about the state of parental leave opportunities for new parents in the U.S. Here's a hint, they're not good. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. Sakina Francis describes her life as a Cinderella story in reverse. She grew up in a well-respected, middle-class African-American family. She went to college, was the homecoming queen, married, began a career, and had children. Then schizophrenia struck, and she lost everything. She went from homecoming queen to being homeless and institutionalized. Sakina's letters to her daughter Anika chronicle the first time she heard voices in her head, her hospitalizations, her struggle to parent, and her arduous path to long-term recovery. Both shaken and moved by her mother's revealing letters, Anika faces the haunting effects her mother's mental illness had on her upbringing. After years of keeping the secret about her mother's illness, Anika breaks her silence, voicing what it was like to grow up with a mother with a severe mental illness. The result is the book Love's All That Matters, a mother and daughter memoir. I recently spoke with both Sanika and Anika Francis and asked Sanika how her ordeal with mental illness began.
Well, I started pulling away from everyone, and the main thing how I started was hearing voices, and voices would tell me things to do and all that, and I had never been there. I thought that I was special because I was hearing the voices, so that's how I was alienating people, and nobody knew what was going on. I was taken to a mental hospital for an interview, and it was discovered that I had a mental illness, and my mental illness was and is paranoid schizophrenia.
And at that time, what did they do to help you? Did they keep you there? Did they treat you as an outpatient? What was done?
Okay, it could have been done better. I think my family, no one knew what this was about. Not for me, but I kind of think family, spouse, children should be set at a conference to tell about what the disease is like, what will happen in the future. I was just given medication. I didn't know what kind of medication, and that medication gave me convulsions. And when I was in the bed, I would curl up almost to a fetal position. And I thought at the time that all mental health medicine would do that. So I didn't tell anybody. My solution was to not take it all the time, spitting it out, and that's not good. But that's what happened with me.
Now, Anika, how old were you when this started, and did you really notice early on what was happening to your mom?
Well, I was 4 years old when my mother was first diagnosed. So my early memories are, a lot of them are just very shaky. I really didn't know what was going on because that was the only mom that I knew. And I think as we went back and worked on telling the story, I don't think a lot of people kind of knew what was happening. The changes at first were very slight, and then they became more full-blown. But for me, I just knew that at times my mom would act a little bit different. But then I was so young, I just kind of thought that was my mom.
As you grew older, when did you start to realize that, mom's a little different than the other moms?
Well, when I was taken away from my mom, so my mom went into the hospital when I was maybe just before the first grade, and I had to go. I was actually put into a foster care home, and I knew something was obviously wrong then. And my mom also would really pull away from the family. So, at the time, I really didn't know what was happening. And I knew that things were definitely different when she came home from the hospital that first time because she was totally different from the mother that I remembered. The mom I remembered was very bubbly and lively, and the person who came home from the hospital that first time was just very withdrawn, didn't have a lot of emotion, very distant, and also just didn't seem very involved in my life either.
Sakina, do you think that the way you were treated was just because, they didn't really know any better at the time?
I have to think so, because at the time, the medicine that I was taking then is no longer on the market. And as I've gone through years, it took me about 10 years to get the right kind of medicine for me. It makes me not have as much weight gain. I'm not quite as sleepy because those were a lot of the side effects before. And now for the last 24 years or 23 years, I've taken the same medicine. I've held jobs. I've been on boards. I've done so well because I have a medicine that has some side effects, but I could deal with them, and it agrees with my system.
Do you think that doctors are starting to treat mental health with parity to physical health, or is there still a difference there?
I still think there's kind of a difference. With me, all I can say with me, when I take the medicine, the doctors enjoy having me as a client and a patient because I do what's supposed to be done, and that mainly is taking medicine, being with family, with friends, volunteer working, going to centers. So for me, I might be the poster child of mental health because I do all these things, and I've been very successful in life doing that. For the last 15 years, I've never missed a day. Before that, I was doing so well, I thought I didn't need medicine, and I went through a year of relapse. So now I know that medicine, like I said, medicine, family, friends, centers, and work helps me a lot.
Tell us about the letters that you wrote to your daughter during this.
Well, to start off, I had gone to NAMI, and I was in their speakers bureau, and we were writing speeches each month. And I was sending the speeches to Anika, and Anika said, "Mom, you ought to write a book." And I said, "Well, Anika, you should too," because some of the things I was telling her in my letters to her are things that I was going through that she didn't know. And she said she was telling me how mental illness affects more than the person that has it. And with her, so I said, "Well, Anika, you ought to write a book." So I write letters to her in this book, starting from when I first had mental illness, a little bit of my growing up and, you know, with my parents, then starting from having mental illness and what happened to me, and it's chronological by years in the book. And then Anika writes what happened to her. And I'm just realizing more how mental illness does affect more than the sick person. I had yesterday, there was a family birthday the family's kind of upset with me. I couldn't send cards and all that because my family is very big on gifts. And now that made me realize when I was in crisis times, on my birthday or on the holidays, I'm sure Anika and my sisters wanted to send me gifts. They didn't know where I was. You might think that that's simple, but that's kind of sad.
And Anika, you're the one, of course, who received these letters. Did they give you added insight into what was going on with your mom and help you, understand a little more?
It really did. It's interesting because my mom, obviously I was very young when she was diagnosed, but it really wasn't until she started sending me the letters that I actually even knew what her official diagnosis was, which was shocking to me when I really sat back and thought about it. In a lot of ways, it was something that was always there, but we didn't always talk about. I was uncomfortable sometimes bringing that up with my mom because she had been in recovery so long, and it's like you don't necessarily want to bring up these kind of tough memories. But I never really knew what happened when she got sick. It wasn't something that we ever discussed. So I got a lot of insight just into what was happening to her, how she felt about me and things that I never knew.
And she, of course, said that mental illness affects more than just the person. It affects the entire family. How did this affect your upbringing, and how did how did this relationship survive over the years?
Well, for me, growing up with a mother with schizophrenia was like being on an emotional roller coaster. There were just so many ups and downs. I wasn't able to count on my mom to be there. And that was really hard when I was young. And not only could I not always count on her to be there, but I wasn't always sure of who would show up. You know, when she was on her medicine, things were great, and we always had a really good relationship. But when she stopped taking the medicine, it's like she completely changed. She'd get very distant. She would become very paranoid. And that was really difficult. So for me, I had a lot of, at times, sense of abandonment when she would be in the hospitals. I think it made me... It definitely was hard for me because I played the role of a parent. I was a caretaker at a very young age, so it made me overly responsible, which was challenging. I definitely don't think I got to play enough when I was young, and I worried so much. And that's difficult, especially at that age. But one of the things that kind of kept our relationship is that we had a very strong family,
and our family really helped create a space for us to stay in each other's lives. And I think through it all, even though I didn't understand things, I always knew I loved my mom, and I always felt that she loved me. And that really, that helped us a lot.
Now that she has been on the medicine as long as she has, is the family healing? Is everything coming together now?
You know, it's interesting because there are a lot of things that we just didn't always talk about. I think with us putting out a book, it's brought more things up that a lot of times it's kind of that elephant in the middle of the room. So I think there's still some room for healing because I think a lot of times healing happens when you're able to kind of look at some of those tough things in your life and be able to release them. But I think that first stage is really hard when you have to kind of look at some things that maybe you buried. So we're still working on that.
Well, you know what? Even every family, that's an ongoing process. So that's
exactly.
Good.
Exactly.
Sakina, now, you do a lot now with mental health. You go and you speak to groups. Tell us when you started doing that.
I started about 5 years ago. But before that, in my crisis years, Bob, it's almost amazing that I'm able to do this now. I was separated from my husband. I had a suicide attempt. I was in a jail for about 8 days. I had numerous hospitalizations. I was on and off medicine. I was sexually exploited by a case manager. So all these I call my crisis years, which were 12 and a half years. Now I could talk on very different levels to policemen, college students, my peers in hospitals. I have first-class knowledge of what it's like to go through, like Anika says, the roller coaster of mental health.
You mentioned policemen. It seems like dealing with the mentally ill is something that police should have extra training in.
They do. They do have, in Cleveland they have, it's called sensitivity training. And I talk a lot to the cadets, the ones that are just starting out. But my very first speech was to about 22 policemen, and they told me they had never seen a person not in crisis that had mental illness. And this was on some of their comments. So when I talk to policemen, I say, when you have the right kind of medicine, there's probably a lot of people that they helped that they just don't know are mental health people. And I kind of give them ways that it's a little bit better to deal with a person in crisis. I tell the ways that was good for me. And they listen. My main thing I tell the police is kind of have one good cop, bad cop, and that works for me.
As you worked with your daughter, have you found that it's really helped you bring this maybe to a little bit of closure with your family and yourself in your mental illness?
Well, me and my daughter have really opened up. We feel so much lighter getting this off our chest. And I think with the family, some things they didn't understand. It's going to take a little healing, like Anika said. But with time, I'm sure it will. And I hope that people can see how successful I am now. People enjoy my speeches. I get such good comments. The book, I've gotten mostly good comments about the book. But I can really say that you can go through it, but don't count us out. We can hang in there, and we can become loving, productive citizens.
Anika, do you see your mother succeeding in the future?
I do, and I think, Bob, that she's succeeding now. You know, there's been a lot of growth that I think we've both had from working on the book, which has been really powerful. I think a big thing for my mom is that she's starting to see not only how the illness impacted her, but she's also seen a lot more so how it impacted me, and I think that's giving her even more depth that she's able to bring when she talks with people. So I definitely see her being even more of a success in the future.
Thank you, Anika.
Now, you have used techniques to kind of bring calmness and peace to yourself. I understand you're a yoga instructor. Do you find that helps?
It helped a lot, Bob, and I really wish I had it when I was younger, when my mom was going through her crisis times. One of the things for me, and I'm sure other caregivers can probably relate to, is that you get into this mode of just trying to save and support that person in need. For me, because I got into those roles when I was so young, I was always feeling like I had to be so strong, that I had to carry the weight of the world, and that's a lot of just stress and pressure, and it took its toll on me over time. So doing things like yoga, which really helped me to become a lot more self-aware, gave me more practices to relieve stress, a lot more practices to become centered, were a really big part of my healing process. And I think that's important for caregivers, because if we're out of balance and we're not really healthy ourselves, then we're not even able to support the other people around us either.
The reason I even called NAMI in the first place, I had just, a job had went bankrupt and I was looking for work, couldn't find it. I was going to be a volunteer at NAMI for children of mentally ill parents, because I had family support and I wanted to help other children that are in the same situation that Anika was in. But I would say to children, don't go too far with your parents. Try to get help if things are going just out of whack with a family member or a teacher or a counselor at your school that cares. Because if you don't get help, sometimes you become, as a child, a silent sufferer. And as we go around with this book, people are opening up about some of their family members that they are estranged from. Some, as they grew up, their parent had mental illness and what happened with them. And the book is bringing different sides, with my side of mental illness, Anika's side of mental illness. So it's a good fit, and maybe now people will speak out a little more. They'll see that you can be successful with a mental illness, and you can go on living, and you can go on being a loving person, and you can be a role model in your community.
Again, the name of Sinika and Anika Francis's book is Love's All That Makes Sense, a mother and daughter memoir. It's published by Bridge Ross Communications.
Still to come, would making parental leave mandatory in the U.S. make a difference? That's next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1309.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs. The United States is one of the only countries in the world that doesn't offer paid parental leave. Veteran reporter Ann Garrels looks at what this means for American families.
When it comes to paid parental leave, the United States is in an exclusive club, along with Papua New Guinea and Swaziland. These are the only three countries in the world that don't have national laws requiring paid maternity leave.
In the United States, working families have far fewer protections than they would have in almost any other country.
That's Janet Walsh. She's the author of a new report on parental leave in the U.S. from Human Rights Watch.
We interviewed 64 parents across the country at all different income levels and different professions, and without a doubt, all of these parents said that they would have benefited tremendously from even a bit of support, even for a few weeks.
In most of the U.S., paid leave is left largely to the whim of employers. Many workers have no paid family or sick leave whatsoever, and about half the workforce isn't even eligible for job-protected unpaid leave. Walsh says this leads to health problems, financial problems, and career disasters.
Your options are to go back to work far sooner than is healthy for you, healthy for your baby, healthy to establish breastfeeding, and just to get back to work within weeks in some cases, or to quit. And we see that in many countries, and even in the United States, there's been studies about employers being able to retain good workers if they have decent policies for parental leave. And so you lose a lot of very qualified workers by not giving them just the basic ability to sustain their families in a short leave in a critical time and get back to work when is healthy.
Those least likely to have any paid leave are low-income workers, those who need it most. A young woman, we'll call her Samantha, is typical of dozens interviewed. She worked for a nonprofit in Brooklyn. After her son was born, she took a month of accrued vacation and sick time. An infected C-section incision forced her to take another month of unexpected, unpaid leave. After 8 weeks, Samantha had to return to work or lose her job.
8 weeks is what my job was telling me was the last week before they could hold my job any longer. So it was kind of like I had to go back that week. It wasn't something that I really wanted to do at the current time. Was I ready? I would say no. I didn't feel like I was ready to go back to work. I wanted to at least have gotten my son his second set of shots before I went back to work as well, because I knew he was going to be around other children. And those are the things that came up in my mind. But it was kind of like, you know, I have no choice. I have to, you know, get back out there and start work right away.
When Samantha got back to work, she couldn't afford to take more unpaid sick days for doctor's visits. The only place she could pump breast milk was in a highly trafficked, unhygienic public restroom with no electrical outlet. She had to stop breastfeeding. And when she couldn't work late shifts after daycare closed, she was let go. Her savings were exhausted, as well as her once stellar credit.
I had 2 student loans I had to put on deferment. My credit cards went into default, so I ended up filing for bankruptcy. So it really, you know, made a big dent in my life, because it's like now I have to wait another 3 to 5 years to build my credit again and to get back on my feet to save. It really put us back.
Samantha's trying to start her own business now so she can have a more flexible schedule.
It's really embarrassing and dreadful that a country as rich as the U.S. treats its families so poorly.
Janet Gornick is professor of political science at the City University of New York Graduate Center. She's an expert on family leave. She says many European countries have excellent policies in place.
In most of these countries, if you give birth or adopt, first of all, you'll have 3 to 5 months in any of the continental countries, similarly in the Nordic countries, of fully paid 100% leave with the right to hold your job and return to it. If you're in a partnership, in some cases a same-sex partnership, certainly in a heterosexual partnership, your use of maternity leave can be supplemented by your own use of some parental leave after the maternity leave. Your male partner can also take parental leave, in many cases up to 6 months frequently. So between you and your partner, you can keep a child at home, certainly throughout the first year of life, as you wish, with a large part of your pay.
Gornick says there's no evidence such programs hurt the overall economy.
Virtually every country in the world has figured out that paid maternity leave is feasible. And nearly every rich country has figured out that paid parental leave is feasible. And these programs are maintained during periods of reassessment and retrenchment and restructuring. And there are 6 countries that I've studied quite a bit that have very good programs of paid leave and child care. That's Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, France, and Belgium. And across virtually every outcome, the results are better in those countries.
Janet Walsh of Human Rights Watch points to successful, if modest, programs in California and New Jersey, the only 2 states with public paid family leave insurance programs.
In New Jersey, for example, workers pay a maximum of $18 a year into a paid family leave insurance fund. This insurance fund then makes it possible for workers to tap into paid family leave benefits for a short time, for about 6 weeks after childbirth or adoption, for example, and get about $560 a month. So this is not some enormous contribution by employees. In fact, there's no government or employer contribution to this fund, but that little contribution makes it possible for workers who really need help at a critical time to get some basic support. So this has not been devastating to other economies. In fact, it's been helpful.
International treaties have long recognized the need to provide better support for working families. Human Rights Watch says it's time for the U.S. to sign on and begin a vigorous public debate on how to implement these policies across the country. I'm Ann Garrels.
That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.